Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Jed Reif. Reif is an independent filmmaker and new media producer. He has produced 11 nationally broadcast public television specials, including California and the American Dream. His documentaries include the milestone film Ishi, the Last of the Yahi, narrated by Linda Hunt, which won Best Documentary at 8 major film festivals and aired on PBS's This American Experience. His feature-length film Waiting to Inhale, Marijuana, Medicine, and the Law, won 3 Best Documentary Awards. His upcoming work as a producer includes A Dangerous Idea, Eugenics, Genetics, and the American Dream, and The Long Shadow. I'm speaking to Jed Reif by phone from his office in Berkeley, California. Jed Reif, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I want to talk about the fact that you've been directing and producing serious documentaries and TV films for many years. I've been wondering what attracted you to this medium in the first place.
Well, I started out in print and radio as a journalist back in the 1960s. And when I came to California, I saw the first half-inch reel-to-reel videos. And I had moved from being a journalist to being an activist against the Vietnam War, civil rights. And I could see that whenever we'd have organized a demonstration, particularly in Texas where I was working at the time, where I came from, I could get a lot more people out if I showed a film. Like, for example, we showed Emilio Zeffirelli's In the Year of the Pig. Mm. Well, I got out an extra 500 people when I had a film screening. And when I came to California a few years later, and I saw people making half-inch reel-to-reel videos, and I was amazed because they could actually set up a rack of monitors and show a video around a concept, around an idea. In most cases, a lot of it was art installations. People like Jules Backus with Optic Nerve and Chip Lord with Ant Farm were doing these really incredible art videos that were really made political statements. Oh. Cadillac Dance is one of those. The Media Burn is another. They're famous in the world. And what they did was, that wasn't what I kind of wanted to do. I wanted to do long-form essay journalism. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really realize that documentaries were just really starting back then.
Yeah, I remember that. It's not a very, very old medium at this point.
No, we had people like the Maisel brothers and folks like that who I didn't hear about until much later. Mm-hmm. Because they weren't shown in Texas.
But in
California, I got exposed to a lot of new things. And I kind of felt that in 1975, I thought, Texas, you know, there was a lot of people making change in California, but still not in Texas. And so I went back there and to produce my first 2 documentaries and get them on PBS.
Wow. So that's how you started out. I want to talk about something more recent. Let's talk about your film of a couple of years ago called Waiting to Inhale, Marijuana, Medicine, and the Law. It's still topical and it's still evolving. Tell us what the angle was on this film. You got a lot of attention for this.
Well, back in during the days of AIDS before the pills came out, mm-hmm. you know, AIDS was an epidemic and it was killing 90% of the people that had AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we did was we volunteered with an AIDS organization, and we found out that people dying from the wasting syndrome, which was basically, I saw grown men go from 200 pounds down to 98 pounds and shut down and
die.
Yeah, I know. But what we found was that cannabis helped them eat, and it helped them feel better.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started helping find cannabis to give to patients. It was a group called Lambda Itinerary. And when a few years after that, Prop 215 was passed here in California, which was the first legislation to legalize cannabis for medicinal purposes. And I met Dr. Donald Abrams, who was head of the AIDS ward at San Francisco General. And I talked to him about the idea of doing a documentary. And he said, he told me at that time he was applying for permission to do the first clinical trials that the federal government had allowed since the 1960s.
Mm.
And I went, wow, well, I'd like to film that. And so I went off, started working on my film. He continued to apply and get turned down for that. We continued to apply and get turned down for grants, but we did get a few of them. And so we started making the film, and a couple of years later, Dr. Abrams called me and said, I've got permission to do this study. Would you want to film it?
Wow, that is so amazing. But it amazes me how controversial this subject still is. It's almost like reefer madness. That 1936 film is still affecting people with fear about marijuana. So are you shocked that this is still evolving in such a way?
Well, you know, we've had $20 billion a year they're still spending, I think, on the drug war.
Yeah.
I mean, and most of it's spent, besides busting mostly African-Americans and people of color, they're also, you know, spending it on propaganda. Mm-hmm. And we've had such propaganda. Think of a whole generation raised on D.A.R.E., you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's out. And so it's fighting this kind of expensive, high-level propaganda, which is still going on. And now we have Jeff Sessions, attorney general, a guy who said, oh, I once liked the Ku Klux Klan until I found out they smoked marijuana.
Yeah.
I mean, that's who is the attorney general.
I know. Wasn't that remarkable? Oh, my God.
And so here, that's the kind of attitude that we have. And he just called for the super criminalization of all drug use and drug sales. And so we've already got prisons full. You know, and this is kind of what drove me to it. I mean, 800,000 people a year getting arrested for cannabis?
I know.
So many of them are medical users.
So I'm so glad you made this film. I know it's probably affected a lot of people. I just wish these kinds of documentary films could be shown more widely in this country. But still, you got a lot of attention for it. Now, let's talk about the fact that you have two new documentaries that are being released, which you are the producer of. One's called A Dangerous Idea, Eugenics, Genetics, and the American Dream. It's got a woman director. To tell us a little bit about it. It's another topical subject that's still evolving.
Well, you know, I don't think people have heard. I mean, you talk about propaganda. You know, we get told over and over again on television, you know, it's Sanjay Gupta sitting there talking about, you know, how there's a gene for terrorism, or there's a gene for criminology, or there's a gene for hypersexuality, or Dr. Phil talks about a gene that causes people to rage.
Mm-hmm.
All this is fraud, and it's a lie, and they know it, but they can perpetuate these lies and get people to watch it because it seems sensational.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have any information about what genes can really do. We're just now beginning to get into epigenetics, and that's still on a test basis. But people are thinking that there's, you know, Ancestry.com, all these kinds of services are promoting a false idea of what our genes tell us. And in fact, what this film tells us is there is no such thing as a gene.
Mm.
There's
mm-hmm.
DNA, there's RNA, they make proteins, but the idea and the concept of a gene is a joke.
Well, it's also used for political reasons, as you said, you know, it's used for racism, to exclude people. Yeah, I mean, they've been doing this for forever.
Well, you know, it's been over 100 years since we started, the eugenics movement started in the United States. It first started in England, but it moved here quickly, and it was embraced by everybody from Jack London to Franklin Roosevelt, to Margaret Sanger.
Mm.
Okay? We have a whole pantheon, as well as the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the Fords. And these people funded something called Cold Springs Harbor, which created a whole science, a whole pseudoscience that produced the results that they wanted to produce that showed people that were not white Anglo-Saxon from Northern Europe were inferior to everybody else in the world.
Yeah.
And this way, ultimately, they created a 20-point program, American Eugenics Society, and these 20 points, number 2 was sterilization, number 10 was euthanasia, and number 13 was laissez-faire, which meant just let them die.
Oh, God.
Which is actually eugenics that's being practiced today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Let people die. They don't have medicine. They don't have the right food, and then you feed them bad food, genetically modified foods. You feed people foods that have no nutrition in them, that are prepackaged and processed. What do we have? We have a system that is actually killing people.
Yeah, so I'm so glad you made this film. It's what an important film this is.
Well, it's going to open in New York in the fall, and mm-hmm. we're really excited about the premiere of the film. And it's some of the people that actually help fund genetics that are actually in the eugenics movement that are now working to undo the damage done by the family's legacy.
Wow.
I think it's going to cause a real sensation when we actually premiere this film,
mm-hmm.
because it challenges all our notions of the genetics as a field of science. One thing I just to say real quick, like Hitler, the first eugenics law in America was Hitler appropriated the sterilization law written by Harry Laughlin at the Cold Springs Harbor. This law was passed, and it was used to sterilize a woman named Carrie Buck and her mother and her sister. And it went on. It was a model law because the Supreme Court had overturned some really bad legislation. But since that time, over 560,000 people have been sterilized against their will in the United States of America. And Hitler took that law, and you saw what he did with it.
Yeah.
He read all the stuff. He gave Harry Laughlin an honorary degree from Heidelberg University. Laughlin said that Hitler was getting ahead of us. Yeah, he sure was.
God, yeah, that's so interesting that you're making a film like this and it's still appropriate in 2017. You know what I wanted to ask you, Jed? As a producer, is it hard for you sometimes to get people to talk on camera about some of these issues?
Not really. In some ways, we find the people that have spent their lives studying and looking at issues and who know them like so well, and they have a unique point of view. Augustine Fuentes is at Notre Dame. He's one of our scholars in A Dangerous Idea. And he very clearly talks about issues, representations of gender and sexuality. And he says, like, you know, these are concepts. Sexuality is real. Gender is not real.
Mm-hmm.
And how eugenics and genetics plays into that. Yeah. And so, but to put him on camera, wind him up, and he is so articulate, you can't believe it. And we had people like Van Jones, Robert Reich, who are a little bit overseen in a lot of ways, but they had very clear and direct comments to make about how this pseudoscience of eugenics and genetics has been used to create public policy that have hurt people of color and people of all ages and classes in America.
Oh, well, I can't wait till that film gets released, A Dangerous Idea, it's called. Another new film that you produced and is due for release is called The Long Shadow, and that's two white daughters of the South are trying to move beyond their white privilege and talk about the long reach of slavery. Now, that's another topical subject to be tackling right now.
Well, I feel so honored that Stephanie Welch, the director of A Dangerous Idea, and her partners, producers, asked me to come on that film. And then Frances Causey is the director of The Long Shadow. And Frances had brought us a film called Heist, Who Stole the American Dream, that she had finished with Donald Goldmacher a few years ago. Very timely film. Heist, Who Stole the American Dream and What You Can Do About It. Very strong advocacy film, and it really dissected the whole collapse of our economy in 2008 and showed where it goes back to back all the way into the 40s and how this has been a tug of war between the oligarchs and the elites that control America and have controlled it ever since the founding of the United States.
Oh, yeah, and it's gotten worse. It's just gotten progressively worse.
And so that shows how that happened and how that resulted. And after she asked us to re-edit it, her and Donald, and we recut the film into and added on some additional kind of framing for it on the beginning and end and bookend it with Occupy, and it just took off like crazy. Played all over the country, sold thousands of DVDs, and it's been used for organizing purposes.
Wow. What was the name of that again?
It's called Heist, Who Stole the American Dream.
Oh, yeah.
You can do about it. And it's available. You can go YouTube. I believe it's available online free right now on YouTube. If not, it's available very inexpensively on many platforms. $1.99, $3.99
on
Amazon.
Oh, that's great. I recommend that people see any film that Jed Reif's involved with. To tell us about The Long Shadow, though, because that's a topical subject as well. I mean, obviously, racism is raising its ugly head every minute in this country.
Well, Frances she was one of the initial team of producers that came on as she was still producing for CNN back when it first started.
Mm.
And she's trained in classical journalism. She's done a series of documentaries. Did a documentary on the first black stock car driver in the United States, which was the first documentary on the first black stock car driver, believe it or not.
I believe it.
Even though it's the most biggest sport in America. And then she did Heist, and then she did a wonderful film on the Tono Odom Indians for the tribe and about their fight with over the big mining company coming in and destroying their water and destroying their sacred land, and which we hear so much about these days. This is down in Arizona. But she's originally from the South. She's from South Carolina. Her producing partner is from Meridian, Mississippi. And they together grew up, and they both grew up as literally the daughters of white privilege. And they're very out front about that. Their families both own slaves on both sides of their families. And, in fact, Frances found out in the course of looking at slavery and the ramifications of it and its impact on today, and she knew her family had owned slaves, so she started there. And she found out that her uncle, seven times back, was the man who wrote the coded language in the Constitution that signaled to all the elites, and that's all who were involved in writing the Constitution. There certainly weren't any indentured servants. There weren't any working class whites. There weren't any slaves involved. But the language said until those that live in a state of society can be free men. Well, African Americans were never presumed to be allowed to live in a state of society.
Mm-hmm.
That's the words that told the other elites that they could go ahead, sign the Declaration of Independence, and that we would have a constitution that made slavery permanent.
Mm.
The other thing that found out in her research that has come to our attention is that, you know, make America's original creation myth is like, you know, taxation without representation, the Boston Tea Party. That's what we've been taught. But do you know what was just getting ready to happen? England had just announced that they were going to abolish slavery in their colonies.
Hmm.
See, it was really to protect their most valuable commodity, human slaves, that George Washington, Edmund Pendleton, her uncle, Thomas Paine, and I have a picture painting of all three of them riding together. That's why Thomas Jefferson, that's why they rebelled. Maybe it was because of that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jed Rife. He is an independent filmmaker and new media producer. We're talking about some of his new films coming out. One's called The Long Shadow. Go ahead and continue and tell us more a little bit more about this.
Well, you know, I mean, so this opens up a whole new way of looking at it. And then I began to find out, and we started doing interviews with John Powell, with Gerald Horn. These are incredible scholars. Leon Littwack, who wrote the book on lynching.
Mm-hmm.
We began to get a whole different perspective of what the American colonies were like, who was running them, and how they had to. There was a rebellion called Bacon's Rebellion. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Bacon organized. It was a group of indentured whites, slaves, and there were some indentured black slaves too, indentured black people as well, Africans, and got them together. And because they were out being, they were actually being forced to go out and take land from the American Indians. And push the Indians back into the farther into the other people's other Indians' country, and as they were doing that, the Indians were attacking, and they were being forced to do this. This is what their jobs were, and they began to see themselves as, why shouldn't they be have the same right? They're taking this land from the Indians. Why shouldn't they have the land?
Mm.
So they got together, the blacks and slaves and the indentured servants. And they organized, and they started to overthrow, rebel against the elites. When they did that, people got very scared. The whites realized that there was more black slaves and indentured white servants than there were them.
Yeah. Oh,
and so what it was, they killed Bacon. So then that stopped that part of the rebellion. Even though you would see rebellions, Prosser's Rebellion, you see other rebellions over time afterwards.
Yeah.
Got together, we're literally blacks and whites. But what they had to do was come up with a way to keep whites, to separate whites from joining with blacks, poor whites, working class whites.
Mm-hmm.
They gave them a little more status. They said, you're white, you're not indentured servants, you work for us, you're our people, and you're going to be our enforcers to enforce slavery, no matter where the slavery is, whether it's a black slave that leaves for a free part of the North. But back, let's face it, Rhode Island was a plantation.
Mm.
Rhode Island Plantation, Providence Plantation. These were giant plantations that were just like in the South.
Wow.
And what we, you know, and as we know, you know, the slave ships, they didn't come from the South. They were made in the North, in the harbors in Boston.
Yeah, exactly.
And
exactly.
Out of Providence.
So this film, the Long Shadow, talks about all these subjects, right?
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. It's amazing how we're still uncovering stuff, mainly because so much history has been hidden because people were not allowed to tell their own stories, right? I mean, to tell us, Jed, what makes you decide to tackle a certain subject? What factors have to be there for you to want to take this on?
Well, the fact that people don't know about it, that it's a subject, or that the subject they think they know a lot about. And what our research or what our studies tell us is that it's a real different story. And we can, if you take the stories and you relook at these stories instead of from a 19th or even early 20th century perspective, and you look at it from a 21st century perspective, but not with a little lens of political correctness, but to look at it, to really get down deep and understand what makes America America?
Mm.
How have we built this country, and how have we created so much influence over the rest of the world? And what is the effect of this? And how is it affecting not only people in America, but people all over?
Mm.
And if we can understand that, and how to figure out how to take control over our lives instead of having somebody else have control over our lives, whether it's the government, the army, the corporations. I envision America of independent people, business owners, entrepreneurs, people doing community work, instead of the corporations running things and the oligarchs. And that's what we have. We have an oligarch, whether
it's a
Democrat, Republican, or whatever. We don't have control over our lives. And and that's my goal, is to give information to people that we can use to organize and make change.
Wow, that's great. So that's your impetus for making these documentaries. Now, I want to ask you this, too, because so many documentaries end up in a rather insular loop of film festivals, right? So social media, podcasts, all this stuff has helped widen the scope for documentaries that used to really just be shown to a few people, right? Isn't this an amazing renaissance of documentary films now?
Well, it is. It's interesting how it's changed. You know, when I started out in 1975, you had to actually reel to reel. Mm-hmm. You didn't have a cassette.
The cassette
then began creating a consumer market for videos, and that and all came along. And then it went to cassettes, and then it went to tape. Now it's digital, and the digital world is really different because it's created new platforms. And instead of the gatekeep, we used to have four television stations, right, in America.
Oh, yeah.
CBS didn't even exist nationally until 1970s. It was individual stations around a little limited theme until the Corporation for Public Broadcasting was created. And then we began to see a proliferation of stations and a real system that began to be created. But still, there was basically ABC, NBC, CBS, and PBS.
Yeah.
And with the advent of cable, all of a sudden we had 500 channels, but still, almost nothing was on. You know, we really, you know, you still didn't see a lot of really good programming. They were rehashing the other stuff. But then HBO and other ones came along, and it began to change the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
And then low technology equipment, the low cost of higher technology and lower cost reduced the barrier to making documentaries for many people. Like when I started out, you know, you had to, it was hell to make and edit a film.
Oh,
it literally was. It was not easy. It was the most challenging, difficult experience. And slowly over time, it's improved. Where now you can, you know, instead of having a $20,000 to $50,000 editing system, you have everything for $300 on your desk.
Isn't that amazing? I know. I mean, when I worked in news in the early days, we had reel to reels and had to cut tape with you know, razor blades. I'm sure you had to do some of the same stuff. But you know what I want to ask you too, Jed? Do you feel like film festivals still have a little bit too much power to make or break a film?
Well, I'm afraid that so often they're chasing the same films, and they're not really looking at all the kind of work out there. And it's a real issue. Like, how do you Sundance last year? Redford announced on Amy Goodman, Democracy Now, and she asked him how many films were submitted to the Sundance. He said 12,000.
Wow.
How do we look at and judge 12,000 films? How do we, what happens to the ones that rise to the top and the ones that never even get seen? And I think that one thing you have to be a documentary filmmaker is you have to be your own marketing team. You have to be your own salesman. This is it's a business. And I think that's one thing that helped me get started and be in this thing is I was trained as a business person. I published my own magazine. It was the first thing I did out of college. And we had to make the magazine pay for itself or we went out of business. Started work for Warner Brothers and Columbia as a subcontractor promoting films like Romeo and Juliet and Zabriskie Point and young adult films to young adult markets. And so I could see that that's what we had to do with documentaries, except I didn't want to reach just young adults. I wanted to reach the people that could make decisions, adults, seniors of all. And when we began organizing, we organized not on campus, but off campus.
Well, you know, that's every artist I've had on tells me that they've had to learn this whole new business, the business of selling your work. So it's not just documentary films. It's everybody in the arts has to take the reins by themselves and learn all these new skills.
Yeah, and but they always had to do it in a way, but there just weren't as many of them. Now everybody can be an artist. Everybody can be a filmmaker. Everybody can do things. And I think, though, there's a level, though, of where there's a kind of a dumbing down, too, in some cases. The real art and craft. And I couldn't make these films by myself. If I didn't have people like Maureen Gosling, if I didn't have people like you, you helped me with two of my films.
Well, thank you for mentioning that.
Actually, you do my narration for me. I mean, we need, you know, this is a team. the best. I can shoot. I can do sound. I can do a little edit. But I can't do it as good as people like Maureen Gosling or Vicente Franco. You know, the cinematographers, the Ray Day, my sound recordist. These people know their crafts. Emeka Mori has taught me so much about filmmaking. She shot for 45 years. She was the first woman cinematographer for PBS.
Wow.
You know, and those people taught me, and I have tried to share that with the people that are working with me, my interns and my colleagues.
Yeah. So, in other words, it really does take a village to be a creative artist, especially in this kind of a realm. That's really interesting. Now, are you working on any new projects, or are you just going to be doing the circuit of film festivals this summer?
Well, we're releasing these two, A Dangerous Idea and The Long Shadow, and the film festival circuit really starts at Telluride, and then IFP in New York, and then Toronto and Mill Valley, and those are in September, early September, all through September. And then we have Chicago and Sundance, etc. After that, and so that's really what we're gearing up for. But we're also going to use film festivals. Some of the other film festivals as part of our engagement campaign. In certain cities, we'll host screenings with partner organizations, but in other cities, we'll tie in with film festivals and our local partner organizations to build an audience there and to drive people out. But we're also working on some other projects. We have a film, One Voice, which is on the Oakland Interfaith Choir. An incredible diverse group led by a gay African-American choir master who's been around 31 years. That film is in process right now. Another film we call Story, which is about the stories that people tell themselves to make themselves sick and that reinforce negative behavior.
Mm.
So we're working on those two projects right now, and we're looking at another film on democracy by looking at Uruguay and comparing Uruguay with American democracy.
Wow.
And I don't know if you've known this, but a few years ago, two ex-leftist leaders in their late 70s who had been locked up during the 70s and 80s by the right-wing dictators, created a third party. And that third party became the party that now runs Uruguay. And Uruguay is dealing with its legacy of slavery. It's created reparations. It now has African-Americans in the legislature. It has legalized drugs, decriminalized all drugs. It has no drug problem anymore.
Wow.
Literally.
Well, Jed, we are almost out of time, so we will have to look forward to this.
And so these are the projects that I'm working on in the future
great.
Now. I have to make sure we get these others out there.
Yeah, good. Before you go, please give us some contact information so people can get in touch and find access to your films.
Well, Jed Reif Films, that's J-E-D, Reif, R-I-F as in Frank, F as in Frank, E, films.com.
Okay.
J-E-D-R-I-F-F-E, films.com.
Well, great. Jed Reif, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with all these films.
Thank you, Tish, for one. I sure appreciate it, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
You too. Bye-bye. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outoboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.